Some of you may be surprised that I have made it from an assistant professor to department chair in just 6 years. Watch out. our department chair couldn't be here, and because I'm officially an invasive species biologist, I am giving this talk. So Hawaii, why ask us, this obscure island 2,300 miles off the west coast, to give a talk that's supposed to be broadly applicable to the question of invasive species? And that's actually an easy one for us to answer. Hawaii, I think, is the ideal case study because we have probably been more impacted by more things than anywhere else on Earth. And in fact, we know that Hawaii has been subject to more biological control introductions than anywhere else. And that means that there were more invasives to get there in the first place to cause a need for biological control introductions. So it's really actually an ideal place to address this issue. And my effort today is going to be to sort of cast a broad net on what's going on in Hawaii and how that relates to everywhere else, and particularly the way that entomology has literally infested almost every aspect of invasive species issues in Hawaii. And I think you'll find more and more that that's going to be true in the mainland. We're a little less sympathetic. Is my time up? We're a little less sympathetic about things like the Asian longhorn borer, the emerald ash borer, these recent introductions which have shocked the mainland, because that happens in Hawaii very, very frequently. In fact, since I've been there, that's happened, and I've only been there 6 years. And I'll show you an example of that that's perhaps at least as devastating as the ash borer or the Asian longhorn borer. So we've been dealing with these problems for a while, and that may serve as a model, but at the end, I think you'll realize, I think it serves as more of a warning. Because we don't have a lot of answers. But I'll try and address some of the economics, and particularly the environmental impacts of invasive insects are easy. But at the end, I'd like to do a little switch, don't be too surprised, and talk about some of the positive aspects of being an entomologist working on invasive species in Hawaii. So we'll get into that. That went backwards. Okay. I'm a Mac person. So. Perhaps the most famous example, if you ask anybody in Hawaii and probably most people anywhere else, biological control. The first thing they'll tell you about is rats and mongoose and how it's a failure, right? Because the mongoose hunts during the day, rats are active at night, so the mongoose, instead of being introduced, it was introduced by sugar planters, incidentally. Instead of controlling rats, they went after the seabirds and did a really good job on them. So you can walk with impunity around the islands and not worry about what seabirds do, but unfortunately we lost a lot of them. And the rats, in turn, preyed on a lot of the native birds and native insects. So both of these were whammies. And it turns out that there's some suspicion that the first rats were actually brought there on purpose by the Polynesians for cultural purposes. They had a tradition of, with a slingshot, of killing rats as a sport. And so there's some idea that even that wasn't truly an invasive, but in fact an introduction that became invasive. The actual costs, and this is stuff that I got from other people because I do not work on mammals, is that the small Indian mongoose, or the dwarf mongoose as we call it, does about $50 million in damage annually in Hawaii and Jamaica. And that includes things like seabird colonies where they have to put up barriers, do trapping, monitoring, that kind of control. And together with rats, they are pretty good at transmitting leptospirosis, which is something that is more of a problem in Hawaii than the rest of the country. We have more cases of that reported than anywhere else. And so the next time you decide to go swimming in a beautiful waterfall pool, think about that. they never put that on the tourist brochures. I would be remiss if I didn't mention termites, because that's what our chair, Ken Grace, works on. All of the termites in Hawaii are invasive. And we share, and we're very generous in sharing, the Formosan termite with you. And in fact, some recent work that we just did demonstrates that one of the probable pathways by which parts of California, Louisiana, I think it's in Georgia now too, you got it from us. And we, of course, got it from Asia. This is one of the most damaging termites. And it turns out that, and there's Ken, here's his favorite bug. He estimated 10 years ago that in Hawaii they were spending about $150 million controlling and doing damage repair for termites. 10 years ago, $150 million, there are approximately 1 million people in the state. You do the math on how much damage termites are causing just in Hawaii. And the damage may be worse there, but you can extrapolate for different areas, and especially if we're serving as a stepping stone for new species of termite to reach the mainland. So that's something that people on the mainland may want to be concerned about, and it's something to think about in terms of quarantine and how we're operating. Some of the more insidious pests, and this is a nuisance pest in a lot of places, but in terms of environmental damage, there's growing evidence that it's been devastating. The yellow jacket, and I realize that's misspelled, I think, but it costs Haleakala National Park approximately $50,000 a year to control a pest that came in on Christmas trees. And it took a while for people to figure this out, but the queens sleep in the, or overwinter in Christmas trees in Oregon in the fall, just before they're cut and shipped to Hawaii. So we are re-inoculating Hawaii with these yellow jacket queens on a regular basis, and they go nuts in the higher elevations preying on native insects, which are completely naive to social insects. So this is one example of a social insect that's become a problem. There's a worse one by far, and that of course is the ants. And again, I'm just using this data from one national park because it's really hard to get broad data for the state in terms of damage, and a lot of pest control operators don't want to share, they consider that proprietary knowledge, how much they're making. Because I tried a bit to do that. But Haleakala National Park is spending between $50,000 and $75,000 a year trying to control Argentine ants, just this species. If you think about that and what park budgets are like, that's an enormous amount of money that they have to spend controlling something that they would probably rather spend in habitat management, improvement, or even purchasing additional land for the park. Instead, it's controlling these ants. You might think, why bother? Well, here's a particularly poignant example. Jim Liebherr at Cornell is a real carabid enthusiast, and there was a species that was described by Perkins and never seen again from Maui, Blackburnia lenta, and it was rediscovered after 100 years, and it's likely doomed because of Argentine ant invasions, and that's what it looks like. You may never see it again. What's actually happening, and this is Paul Krushelnitsky's work, is that these Argentine ants, as they sweep through a new area, are eliminating approximately 50% of the native insect fauna in the initial sweep, because he's not coming back 10 years later. He's doing this on the front line because we have this opportunity to document the devastation. So that beetle that you just saw, which we've finally rediscovered, we're actually rediscovering it as it goes extinct, and these ants go through and knock it out. So it's interesting data, but it's amazing the devastation that this single species, the Argentine ant, can cause. And that's not even our worst ant problem. In fact, Phidolia megacephala, the big-headed ant, is responsible, I would argue, for more invertebrate extinctions than any other insect. It has swept through the lowlands of Hawaii since, I think, the early 1900s. And Perkins, who is a famous ornithologist and entomologist in Hawaii, documented it. He found a flightless fly crawling around in the leaf litter on a mountain called Tantalus, which is just above the university. And he was very excited, and he took notes on that. He went back a year later. The big-headed ants had come through, and this species, which he had just found the year before, was completely extinct. And you can imagine that a flightless fly would not fare well against a bunch of roving ants. So this species has probably been responsible, Phidolia megacephala, for more of those kinds of extinctions because it's very widespread on all the islands in lower elevations. And we're just getting the Argentine ant to take care of the high elevation insects more recently. So that's been a more recent introduction. From an agricultural perspective, ants are a problem because they're well known to tend and protect plant-sucking insects, which then adds to crop damage. And if you try to introduce a biological control agent for whatever your Homopteran or Alkanarinkan pest is, the ants will prevent that from being successful. So you've got these feedback effects, and entomologists are really at the center of controlling this sort of issue. I'm now going to shift a little bit and get into some more specifics, because I imagine you've heard about invasive species in general. I'm going to talk specifically about a couple of projects that we're doing that I think have broader implications, and actually show you maybe a little bit of hard data. To quickly introduce Omiotes, this is a genus, used to be a pyralid, now they call them crambids. They're all over the world, but Hawaii, we have 23 endemic species. Here are a few of them. Even if you don't like moths, I think you have to agree at least this one's kind of pretty. And they feed on monocots and legumes. Around the world, there's some major agricultural pests on soybean and other crops. But in Hawaii, there's of these 23 endemics, there's only two that have really become problems. And most of them are occurring on multiple islands, or used to, but we do have a few single island endemics. And one of the most, I think, intimidating Omiyotes is this. This is Will Haynes. He's a grad student who has done a lot of the work on Omiyotes, and another one, Cynthia King, is also here. So if you have more questions about that, I'll deflect those to them. But one of the interesting things about Omiyotes is it's one of the only cases, or the only case, where biological control agents were brought into Hawaii to control native, in fact, endemic insects. Morally, these days, that's something that we might question, but in the last 100 years, that's changed a lot. And it wasn't even 50, 60 years ago that that was considered appropriate, because these two insects were damaging sugarcane and coconut. And here you can see a little bit of the damage they might cause on coconut. So that was a really unusual decision to make. And in fact, what happened is they introduced generalist parasitoids, similar to things like Meteoris here, and they were then implicated in the decline and extinction of many, many species of Omiyotes and a lot of other insects in Hawaii. And Howarth, Frank Howarth, was one of the first to bring this up. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about it, opening Pandora's box, the idea that biological control introductions may be more dangerous and are irreversible when you compare them to, say, things like DDT, although you could really argue about that. But Frank would say, it's better because you can control that, you can stop it, you can put it back in the box. Whereas once a biological control agent has been introduced, that's it, it's there. And in this case, they've wiped out, or he would say they've wiped out a significant portion of the native fauna. Is that a worthwhile exchange for us to be making? And there's been other issues that have gone back and forth, and now it seems that these agents that were introduced for to control crop pests have in fact effectively invaded native forests and places that we considered pristine, and they're in fact causing damage on native insects in nature reserves well away from their intended purpose. Again, this is a hot topic. There's a lot of controversy about how much damage they're causing, and that's one of the things that I would gladly deflect to Cynthia, because that was the source of her thesis. But why? What's the big deal? So we lose a few moths. This might be a case or a case I would plead to encourage you to change your mind if that was your feeling. One of the neat things about Hawaii is this idea of evolutionary novelty. And there were 5 species of Omiyotes that were reared only from banana. But banana was introduced by the Polynesians approximately 1,500 years ago. So are we talking about speciation in just 1,500 years, where one species has become 5 or 6? Well, it turns out it may not be that simple when we do the actual analysis, but at least being able to ask this question and having these moths around would have been nice from a very broad evolutionary perspective, Hawaii set aside. The problem is we've had a lot of trouble finding most of these again, and many of them may in fact be extinct. So truly answering this question is going to be tough because of likely introduced ants and introduced biological control agents. How much of a loss is that? That depends on your interest in evolution. I hope in this room it's fairly high. But these declines from introduced biological control agents were noted gradually over time, and 14 of the 23 species of Omiyotes were listed as extinct by very superficial surveys by Frank Howarth and some other folks who've done a lot of work, so it's not a discredit to them. But recent hard work by my students, certainly not me, has rediscovered several of these species. So there is some hope, and that's something I also want to emphasize, is that this isn't a lost cause or a done deal. But there are some that we are pretty sure are now extinct, and you're looking at one here, Omiyotes telegrapha, that was only collected once. The species is gone, and we don't know why. It's in an area that still has some forest, some habitat. So that's something that would be nice to understand a little bit better. Yes, we lost this moth, but at least understand how are these different invasive species interacting and causing the loss of native faunas. Is this environmental pollution really eliminating native insects, or are we just having trouble finding them? That would be something I'd also like to understand a little bit better. Omiyotes epicentra, you can tell, Waikiki, it never had a chance. That's all hotels and things like that now. It's easy to ascribe that perhaps to habitat destruction. But those are insects we will probably never see again in the flesh. Here's one I like to show because many people, at least Lepidopterists, have heard of it, but almost nobody's ever seen one alive, myself included. And so I consider it sort of the Lepidopteran unicorn. In fact, when it was first sent to I think it was the British Museum, but it might have been the National Museum here, from Hawaii. They thought it was mislabeled. This is clearly a new species from Southeast Asia. There's no way there's something this big, this pretty in Hawaii that we miss. This is a big sphinx moth. And it turns out, even since its discovery, and that hoax was debunked because we found more, we've only found 20 individuals of this moth in the last 100 years. And this is something that people would collect if they saw it. They would notice it. It's a big green moth. So it's really a mystery. And one of the problems with that is it's been dropped as a candidate for listing because we don't know anything about it. The larva has never been seen. The host plant isn't known. There's not enough data to list it. And so the bizarre catch-22 is because we don't have the data to list something, and we don't have the data because it's so rare, it's not going to get protected. And therefore, I don't think it's going to get less rare. but I don't work for the federal government. And the question beyond that, which I think would be really emergent, is why is it so rare? Is it parasitoids? Is it other invasives? Has it always been this way? We have to work towards understanding that so we can understand what aspects of biological pollution are, in fact, causing the rarity or extinction of different species. I think this is just a really good poster child, a panda, if you will. Now to go into something a little bit broader, how are insects impacting other fields in Hawaii? And of course, you have to go to mosquitoes, vectoring bird pox, and avian malaria. Here is a native bird, an endemic honey creeper. Most of them are extinct. This is one of the ones that's still hanging around. This is a honey creeper. This is a honey creeper on bird pox. So this has been a really effective way to eliminate native birds, introduce a disease, introduce a vector that they're naive to, and then let it go. And in fact, it's caused massive damage there. Part of the reason that mosquitoes have been successful, some people think, is because of the introduction of pigs, feral pigs. It's surprising how hard it is to get a picture of a live feral pig. Most people kill them and then take pictures, and I didn't think that was appropriate. But it's appropriate to kill it, just not the picture. But what the pigs do is knock over native ferns, eat the hearts out of them, and then that allows water to collect there, which is an ideal place for the mosquitoes to breed. The mosquitoes breed there, fly up into the native forest, and attack the native honey creepers. Some people say that if you didn't have the pigs there, creating these artificial wallows and water sources, the mosquitoes would have a lot less breeding opportunity, and the disease would not be spread nearly as effectively. Again, this is a whole feedback between mosquitoes, pigs, introduced diseases, and then finally native birds. It really centers around the mosquitoes as vectors, and therefore around us as entomologists. So there's a lot of opportunity to contribute to this, to understand the system a lot better, and in fact then hold what's left of this, to many people, very valuable Hawaiian natural history, that is the birds, together. But the chances of that are low at this point. And in fact, I would argue that introduced insects in the form of ants and mosquitoes has probably played a dominant role in the extinction of about 50% of the endemic bird fauna, and I would say an unknown, but based on Paul Krushenitsky's work, probably 50% or more of the native insect fauna. So introduced insects in Hawaii have done a really good job of wiping out perhaps the two most important pollinator groups in the islands. And I would say that safely because birds and insects are the two main pollinators in most places, and in Hawaii that's especially so. So think of the downstream effects of knocking out pollinators. That's something that people on a global basis are interested in. Hawaii, again, would serve as a really good example of a place where you could look at and study how the extinction of pollinators affects plant pollination diversity and persistence. So it's, again, Hawaii could play a central role in that. People are working on that, but it's something that entomologists have to play a central role in, not only because of the pollinators, but because of the other introduced insects which have eliminated those pollinators or eliminated the birds that are serving as pollinators. So again, entomology is really in the middle of that. Now for something a little more pleasant. This is a picture of native forest, and actually I'm going to show you more horrific slides, but this is where I think entomologists can make a positive contribution to controlling other invasive species. I think we really hold the key to that in most of the world, and if we learn the lessons of earlier biological control errors, I think we can be the fundamental units for change in terms of environmental management, that is the improvement of it. This is a picture of native forest in Hawaii. That's what it looks like. You can see there's kind of a diversity here. You've got some koa, maybe some ohia, charpenteria. This is a native fern down below. You get an introduction and it turns into this. And even the undergrads can see the difference. You're laughing, but you know it's true. So this is Casuarina, introduced ironwood, and the needles form a mat underneath, and there is nothing growing here but ironwood. You think, oh, come on, Dan, it's just ironwood. What's the big deal? Okay, here's guava. These hapless tourists are wandering through a forest they think is native Hawaii. It's guava from Brazil in a way that it doesn't look in Brazil even, because it dominates here in Hawaii. It's allelopathic. That means that the roots are excreting chemicals that are preventing other plants from germinating, and you can imagine how vulnerable Hawaiian naive plants are to allelochemicals from a plant from Brazil. And you can see it's completely barren in the understory, just sticks of guava. Okay, even if you don't care about the plants, even if you don't care about the insects, if you like to drink water, this is relevant, because you can imagine when you're having a heavy rain, water retention in a guava forest like this is going to be much, much poorer than something sponge-like as we saw in the earlier native forest pictures. So rain falls, native forest will hold it and release it slowly. These do not. We don't in Hawaii have access to long river systems to draw our water from. The water falls and gets to the ocean pretty quickly. So if you don't have a native forest that can soak up the water and hold it, you can have a drought even though it's a relatively wet place. And in fact, that's true in Hawaii a lot of the time. There are drought conditions right now across many of the islands. But if you went there, you'd say, it just rained 4 inches in the last 2 weeks. How is this possible? Well, we can't really say it's all because of invasive species right now, like guava, but certainly they're going to play an increasing role in that. And one of the issues is that guava continues to spread in Hawaii. So this is something that was introduced in 1820, and it's continuing to eat the native forest for the last, 180, 190 years, and that process is not done yet, so the damage is going to continue. What do we do about it? Entomologists to the rescue, hopefully. This is a gall-forming scale from Brazil that is specialized on this strawberry guava. Tracy Johnson has done this work with the U.S. Forest Service, or at least I would say spearheaded it, and spent 7 or 8 years at least demonstrating unequivocally that it only feeds on strawberry guava. It's not going to wipe it out, but it'll control it and slow the spread of this tree into additional forest and make it a little bit less of a super plant in Hawaii, bringing it back down to size. One of the challenges we're facing is that there's a lot of locals who use the fruit, but more it's because they want the pigs up there eating the fruit so that there are more pigs for them to hunt. So suddenly entomologists are thrown into this sociological issue we have no training for and little understanding of. And that's one of the battles that Tracy is facing right now. To introduce this scale, he's got to convince pig hunters that it's not going to wipe out their entertainment. So again, as entomologists, he's right in the center of a very sociological issue, but this is something we can all learn from and hopefully improve upon in future introductions and the PR that we need to do beforehand. It's not something we really expected, but it is causing a problem right now. You can imagine how important it would be to get guava under control. And I'm going to introduce some of my colleagues and a little bit of work that we've done on another introduction that I think you'll find reminiscent of the emerald ash borer and the Asian longhorn borer, working on erythrina, that is the coral trees. A lot of endemic Hawaiian ecosystems are largely gone. One of the most significantly reduced is the Hawaiian dry forest ecosystem. And the backbone of that is this coral tree, this erythrina, willy willy. Recently a wasp was introduced, and I'll show it to you at the end. It's unremarkable, but what it does is basically blowtorch the trees. And I'll show you some pictures of that. What results from that is basically a forest of ghosts. And that leads to a lot of rapid mood changes for us in difficult times. And so Russ, you know how he is. And Mark Wright was another person, our colleague of mine that was working on this, and you can see he's clearly depressed. But what he's showing you is a healthy erythrina tree, believe it or not. And these are leaves from a tree in South Africa, because it's really hard to find an erythrina tree outside in Hawaii that still has leaves on it. What you actually see is this. And these little galls here look nothing and function nothing like leaves. This is a tree that has been thoroughly infested by the erythrina gall wasp. And here's a parking lot, and you can see it looks like winter, which as you well know, we don't get in Hawaii. This is, again, the gall wasp attacking. And a close-up of these hideous galls, you can see that the leaves become more and more deformed. This is early on, and then finally, they end up as these sort of deformed little fists that are loaded with the maggots of the erythrina gall wasp. which looks like this. And this is actually a good picture of them. So this is a wasp that's causing significant damage. It's knocking out one of the backbones of a native ecosystem. And in fact, we don't even know where it came from. This is a little bit of phylogenetic work. I'm going to end with this. And what we've been able to demonstrate is that this wasp, in fact, swept across the entire Indian and Pacific Ocean basins in the matter of 4 or 5 years and completely eliminated this genus of tree in its wake. So not only is it knocking out Hawaii, but it's knocking out Erythrina in Taiwan, China, American Samoa, Guam, Okinawa, Singapore, and it was recently found in Florida. So this is something that is incredibly explosive. I would argue it operates more like a pathogen than even an insect in the way it spreads and the speed with which it spreads. What do we do next? I'm not sure, but the one thing I would say is that quarantine has got to be better, because if you can see something spreading this fast across the largest ocean basin in the world, plus some in the Indian Ocean, clearly something has to be done. And that's something I want to get to. The final lessons that I think we as entomologists can contribute are the cost of these invasive insects each time they come in is really hard to predict. We just had a butterfly come into Hawaii. It's going to probably be harmless. It just feeds on sleeping grass. But mosquitoes, they're a nuisance to us, but they're a disease vector waiting to happen in Hawaii, because we don't have the diseases yet. That would be dengue or malaria. They're death knell already for the native birds. You can imagine what would happen if we got malaria or dengue there. Dengue is resident in Tahiti, despite what they tell you on the tourist brochures. And again, the cost of prevention is something that people are always talking about and saying, no, it's too expensive, we can't do this. But the cost of elimination is also something we can talk about. Eliminating might be something that most people don't want to do, but it is, in some cases, our only chance. And I do think with incipient invasions, there's an opportunity to do something like this. And I do think this is where entomologists can step in and assess the best option. Is there a chance of eliminating this? What could we do to do that? And is this currently done? Are we participating in that process? Because insects are a major source of biological pollution and damage, but we also have the keys to remediating a lot of this damage. That is, we can introduce wasps, which we're going to do, that will eat the wasp, the Erythrina gall wasp, and at least control it in Hawaii and allow the Erythrina to come back. We can do something about the guava. We might be able to do something about Casuarina. And again, because Hawaii is the front line for all this kind of stuff, it's a really good place to examine these issues and perhaps to learn from our mistakes and improve it on the mainland before more things like the Asian longhorn beetle or the emerald ash borer become a problem here, because those are only two examples, and I could give you so many more from Hawaii that could come here in different ways or enact significant environmental damage. And I really call this right now the wimpy solution. And I mean wimpy in both ways, but particularly from Popeye, where he says he'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. And what we do is we would gladly pay later in terms of down-the-line control, spraying, loss of insects, loss of native birds, loss of native plants, rather than paying a little bit today, that is, quarantine. Paying a little bit more for imports. Instead, we'd rather pay less for imports right now so that we don't have to, in the end, we're going to end up paying more, because the cost of damage for controlling these invasive species is going to be far more than the cost of additional quarantine would be. And I guess I would ask, if a kid's cartoon from 1960s figured this out, and how ridiculous that is as a model, the idea of paying downstream and getting things cheaper up front, why can't we figure that out? And as entomologists, why can't we clearly explain this to the public? I don't have the answer. I'm as guilty as anyone. But I think that's the next step in controlling this biological pollution issue. Thank you.
Do you have time for questions?